Hey guys, welcome
how
back
doing?
To Fudge Feels. It's Gabby and Esther.
And we're back for yet another episode of Shabbat Feels. So
we have a very special guest this time.
Her name is Vanessa Oakes. So Vanessa Oakes is a professor in the Department of Religious Studies and a member of the Jewish Studies program at the University of Virginia. An anthropologist of religion, she's also a rabbi, ordained in 2012. Her books include Inventing Jewish Ritual, winner of a 2007 National Jewish Book Award, Sarah Laughed, and Words on Fire, One Woman's Journey into the Sacred. Her newest book is The Passover Haggadah, a biography published by Princeton University Press.
Needless to say, she's awesome, and we're so excited to have her talking with us today.
This episode today is going to have a whole bunch packed into our interview with Vanessa. It was honestly a really great experience. We're actually recording this intro kind of after the fact, after we've already done this interview with her. But what you're going to hear today is everything from the history of Jewish feminist icons with a whole lot of chutzpah to traditional women's roles in the Jewish faith and also fighting for a seat at the table of progressive movements. As not just a woman, but a Jewish woman, which I think is something that Gabby and I find really important. So this episode today is sort of dedicated to all of our lady listeners of our podcast.
Oh, yeah. And make sure you stick around till the end because we'll give you guys a list of great resources if you want to look into these topics further.
So without further ado, here's our interview, I guess.
I need to stop laughing for this.
Thank you so much for doing this with us and for being willing to like answer certain questions that we had that we wanted to kind of put on our podcast.
So I'll ask one at a time, but our first question is just to get us started, what are some of the restrictions, but also maybe special like special obligations or requirements for women in Judaism? Whether that's regarding reading the Torah, putting on tefillin, performances, like what are the various regulations for women specifically in Jewish law?
So when you ask a question about restrictions and obligations for women, you're talking, I think it's important that you need to be very clear about which denomination of Judaism you're talking about. So for me, as a liberal Jew, my obligation is to pray, is to study Torah, is to teach, to observe dietary laws, to keep those dietary laws for my family, and to do that along with my husband, to be a role model for my granddaughter and grandsons. As someone who is a rabbi and teaches and observes and teaches them Torah. So for a liberal Jewish woman, essentially her obligations are all the same obligations that the Jewish men have had historically. For women in Orthodox Judaism, they're in ultra-Orthodox Judaism, they're somewhat different in that among the ultra-Orthodox, their societies are fairly gendered. And so it would be unlikely to see a woman sitting in a yeshiva, learning Talmud, learning Mishnah. However, an ultra-Orthodox woman would be extremely well-versed in Torah, and well-versed in halacha, in Jewish law, and might even, you know, if you were to have a test of reform rabbis, male and female, conservative and reform rabbis, male and female, and ultra-Orthodox women in Jewish law, you might find that those ultra-Orthodox women who have been learning the law since they were toddlers might actually have more on the top of their heads than folks who had just been learning it recently. in ultra-Orthodoxy, men are the ones who are obliged primarily to teach children, but women certainly are playing very large roles in teaching children. Among Orthodox Jews, there are a lot of changes that have taken place in the last years. Right now, it's possible in certain sects of modern Orthodoxy for women to become rabbis, which means that they are learning as much Mishnah and Talmud and responsa and codes as men, and are can make decisions about halacha, about Jewish law. They in their teaching Torah, they won't. There's certain parts of a service that they won't lead, but there are other parts of a service that they would, and they would read Torah in public and give sermons in public. So what we're seeing, I would have answered this question very, very differently 30 years ago, but every aspect of Judaism, including ultra-Orthodoxy, where young girls now, where girls now have a bat mitzvah, where there are ceremonies when a baby girl is born, every single one of the communities where women express themselves in an observant way as Jews have this broad opening that's been created by the women's movement and by feminist Judaism. So we live in radically transformed times. Mm-hmm.
So in addition to in traditional halakha, what practices may be restricted for women, do we think that those restrictions are always viewed as oppressive by women in the Orthodox community? Or is it possible that women have the agency to say whether or not they like that lifestyle? And if some of these things that could be viewed as oppressive may actually be liberating to women, what is the debate about that topic?
Why don't you be more specific and tell me what kind of a practice that you're thinking of?
Yeah. So for example, I once heard an Orthodox woman, or I was speaking with an Orthodox woman about how on Shabbat, let's say she wanted to put on tefillin, and her traditional practice, you know, that's not something that women are allowed to do. And does that make her feel like oppressed or excluded from certain practices in Judaism? And her answer to me was, no, why would I ever want to put on tefillin? That's for a man. And on Shabbat, I like to stay in the kitchen because that's my role. And that's what brings me like happiness and satisfaction. But personally, if I was in that environment, I would feel very restricted having to stay in a particular role on Shabbat and not be able to observe it in the way that I would want to. So what are your kind of thoughts on these varying perspectives?
Well, first of all, no Jew, male or female, would wear tefillin on Shabbat. That's a time when you're prohibited from wearing tefillin. Men and women, men and certain Jewish women will wear a tallit on Shabbat. And so probably what she was talking about was wearing a tallit on Shabbat or during the days. And if you read text, you'll learn that there were women in history who did wear a tallit and who did wear four-cornered garments and had strings on them. So I would say women being forbidden from wearing tallit, I think that's more sociological. It probably reflects those Jewish communities where there are very strict rules about dressing like a woman or dressing like a man. So the woman who isn't wearing a tallit is probably in her community, she's also not wearing pants, and if she's married, she's probably also covering her head. So every society has its rules about what's permitted dress, what's encouraged dress, what's considered taboo. And if women are finding the rules in their communities fulfilling, then that's wonderful. mean, there are people at UVA who find it fulfilling right now to follow the rule of wearing a mask. And there are UVA students who, as we're hearing, don't feel fulfilled by that role. And so they're not doing it. Whether a woman, an Orthodox Jewish woman, wears what's required of her, she will experience some social. If she doesn't, she can experience social shunning. She might also feel that she's got to leave the community if it makes her uncomfortable. As for the Jewish woman the Orthodox woman who wants to be in her kitchen on Shabbat, this is really unusual to me because all of the cooking for Shabbat is done beforehand. So I'm not sure what she's doing in her kitchen other than waiting for her husband to come home from synagogue. I mean, most Orthodox women I know are in synagogue. The reason they might not be is if they live in a place where there isn't an Eruv, a wire around a community that allows them to push a carriage with a child. But most Orthodox women I know really want to be in synagogue. They want to pray. They want to hear the prayers said. They want to hear the Torah being taught. They want to see their children learning the prayers. They want to be a role model as people who pray. So, you know, so it strikes me as odd that this particular woman is so alienated from community worship that she wants to sit in her kitchen where she can't really do very much.
I think it was probably a separate conversation than like Shabbat practices, but instead it was just like within a conversation generally about women's roles, not necessarily on Shabbat specifically. So that was my mistake in communicating.
I think that a gender stereotype that Jewish women are cooking and men are out in the world. I mean, if we look at Jewish women historically, we have this image of the man sitting in the yeshiva learning, and women are the ones who are out in the world, who are merchants and who are making deals and they're making matches for their children and they're certainly milking cows and doing all kinds of work. So I think we shouldn't conflate historical Judaism with 1950s suburban Jewish life.
Uh-huh.
Again, in my family, we have every Jewish denomination in my family. And all of my ultra-Orthodox cousins all work full-time outside the house. Some of them have businesses. Some of them employ their husbands. So, you know, this idea of the ultra-Orthodox woman as a homebody who cooks and cleans and sews is somewhat outdated,
mm-hmm.
or at least it's placed in the 1950s. I mean, we have very public models of this amazing woman, I believe from Brooklyn, she's a mother of many children, and she is the head of an EMT squad, and she's a judge. Like, this is extraordinary.
Right. And I also think that just weighing in on like things that I've seen on like media, for example, like the show Unorthodox in a way paints women as only being homebodies. And I think that for a lot of people who are not Jewish and who don't know about the different denominations of Judaism, that's how they might like conflate Orthodox Jews and like their roles for women. But as you said, I think that's not necessarily the case for most Jewish women, especially those who are
Orthodox. Yeah. I mean, ultra-Orthodox is a fiction. I mean, if you watch it and then you read the author's biography, they're very different. They're very different stories.
So going off from there, sort of another question we had was, are there any particular Jewish feminist activists in history that allowed women to go from not being able, for example, to be rabbis to being able to become rabbis, and just women throughout history, like Jewish women throughout history, that have paved the way for us to sort of have more, I guess, capabilities within the Jewish religion?
Absolutely. I mean, in the Talmud, we have the figure of Bruria, a learned woman who's a rabbi's voice and a rabbi's wife, and she's cited for her teachings, and she's cited as being learned. Unfortunately, there are also Breuer's stories in which she is demeaned because sages over the years couldn't handle the idea of this learned woman. But it matters very much that she exists in the texts. We have stories of women in Hasidic communities who were teaching others. Not all that long ago, we have this beautiful story of Henriette Isolde, who became the founder of the Hadassah organization, which a lot of mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers are part of. And she was studying at the Jewish Theological Seminary. She was taking the same courses as rabbinical students. They wouldn't allow her to get a degree, but she had the same learning that they did. She created the Jewish public. She was an editor of the Jewish Publication Society. And when her father died, she was one of several sisters. And someone wrote to her, a man named Peretz, I believe. He wrote to her and he offered to say Kaddish for her and her sisters on her father for her father. And if I'm remembering the story correctly, she said that, no, this is something that I will do. And the idea that a woman would say Kaddish for her loved one was, and she said that that's what her parent would want. And that set up a very beautiful role model. The most powerful Jewish feminists in our age are those who were the women who fought to become rabbis. And they did so because they organized and they worked together because sisterhood is powerful. And they, at the same time, there were scholars like Paula Hyman and Rachel Adler, Cynthia Ozick, who were writing really important books and articles. Blue Greenberg, very important Orthodox Jewish feminist, who were challenging the status quo and saying, given if we live in a democratic country where women and men are equal, and we're living in a time of new feminist ideals, if we look deeply at Judaism and the moral trajectory of Judaism, then we see very clearly that it's no longer acceptable that women will be diminished and women won't have agency in marriage and divorce and in communal life. In America, Judaism is generally thought of as a public religion that takes place in synagogues. And so it's understandable that the biggest move was for the public role of women. Women in synagogue being counted in a minyan and a prayer quorum, women wearing tallit and tefillin, wearing a kippah, leading services, becoming a rabbi. I would say in Israel, more of the feminist push initially concerned issues of personal status. Because it's while Israel is a secular country, the ultra-Orthodox have the largest say in matters of personal status in Israel when it concerns issues of who is a Jew, marriage, and divorce.
I see. So in regards to that question and Jewish women being part of just the intersectional Jewish movement in general, I feel like one of the issues that we've seen come up is Jewish people and Jewish women in particular not being given a seat at the table for certain modern progressive feminist movements, for example, the Women's March or like Pride, where the Jewish Pride flag was asked to not be shown at one Pride festival. Although that's not a feminist march, it still encapsulates just modern progressive movements. We were wondering in the remaining time that we have, whether you could give some advice to listeners who oftentimes hear phrases being thrown out on the left, like you can't be both a feminist and a Zionist or things like that, that are bordering into anti-Semitic territory. And if you have any advice on how they can fight for their seat at the table.
Right. So those issues that you raise are really difficult ones. worth having a little bit of historical background that the women's movement in America was the product in many ways of many, was in large part the product of many Jewish women, primarily secular women, Betty Friedan, Letty Cotton Pogrebin, Gloria Steinem, and so many others who felt a sense of disenfranchisement. They experienced it, but they also knew from their Jewish backgrounds, they knew about the need for equality, the need for social justice. And so these weren't always the women who were part of religious Jewish feminism, but religious Jewish feminism would not have taken off when it did, if not for the women's movement in America. So some of the issues that you're raising have to do with issues of Zionism in America, and the role that that Israel plays for Jews. And I think something that's important is for Jews to be able to, young Jews in particular. So if we're talking about UVA community, it's important for us all to think independently about our feelings about the state of Israel, and for us to realize that we, for instance, I'll speak for myself, is that I can be very disturbed about the occupation, and that's not the complete story of my connection to Israel as a homeland, or Israel as a place I love, in the same way that during that I can be very upset about racism and ecological issues in America, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to stop being an American citizen. So I think, first of all, it's important for Jewish women to understand, for Jews in general to understand what are their genuine feelings about Israel, and to realize that yes, they are experiencing anti-Semitism when they're sidelined in Pride and when they're sidelined in the Women's March. And the thing that you do is, just as you stand up against racism and homophobia, you stand up against anti-Semitism. You stand up loud and clear. You do it at UVA. You practice doing it at UVA and in a small club at UVA. And you use every strategic skill that you've learned at the Batten School or McIntyre, or in your poli-sci courses, you learn about organizing. You learn about using the press. You learn about gradual change. You learn about how do you acquire power and influence. And you learn for sure that you can't just do it once. I wrote a letter. I wrote a letter and they were unhappy. You use, if you have money, you use your money, as philanthropists always do, to say, you're not going to allow me to march as a Jew at your pride parade. Fine. You can't have, I'm just not going to provide a float. Fine. I said I was going to make sure that we had police coverage. I'm not. I mean, people, if you have financial ability, you use it in order to promote social justice. Just as the first yeshivot for women in Orthodoxy were primarily created by well-to-do Jewish women who were able to use their money to create social change. I remember, I love the story of a woman whose daughter went to, I think it was Ramaz or Frisch or one of those stories, a very well-to-do woman who supported the school. And she was told that one year her daughter in high school, while the boys learned Talmud, the girls would learn sewing. And she said, if that's the case, she would no longer be supporting the school. Well, guess what? The next year, the girls were learning Talmud too. And that's important. We have different ways of seeking social change. And one way that never works, never, never works, is to wait for enlightened people on the other, for people who oppose the change or don't know it ought to be there. We wait for them to see justice, to see the goodness of our, the goodness and the rightness of our cause. I mean, I've been working for the rights of Jewish women to pray together out loud and with a tallit at the Western Wall for over 30 years, and just waiting for our opponents to see the light of day, the light of goodness. That has never been a strategy that's worked. I mean, we raised money, we brought our case to the Israeli Supreme Court, and we fought, and we show up all the time. That was a lecture, I'm sorry, but I clearly feel really strongly about that.
I really did. I think I myself, I'm going to take a lot of that advice, because I feel like as young women, sometimes you feel like you, I don't know, have to internalize certain things or back down, but that leaves you unsettled within yourself. And I think that finding the power to speak up is something that I myself am still working towards. But just for our listeners to you know, hear that and sort of realize that for themselves is really important.
You also have to realize what's the right cause for you at this time, given your powers and energies. If you have to get into med school so you can so you can become a doctor who's gonna go to Mali and reverse early childhood mortality, then maybe you don't have the time right now to address an argument that's going on at UVA Hillel. You might not have the time to do that, and I recognize that we all have to put our energies, we have to use them in the right time and place. We also have to engage in battles where we think that we can organize in some way. You never win if you're the sole soldier. You always need a powerful force, and you need allies.
So in that regard, we've talked a lot about Jewish feminism across time, across cultures and denominations. Could you point our listeners perhaps to a couple resources if they want to engage in a particular topic that we touched on a bit deeper?
That's a great question. Thank you, Gabby, for that. The Jewish Women's Archive, that's probably jwa.org. is a wonderful repository of information about the entire history of Jewish feminism in America and abroad. Tremendous scholarly resources, and Jewish Women's Encyclopedia is there. It's also a place where even, for sure, one of our UVA students was a fellow there, and that's a great place to look for information. Another place is, and we didn't talk about women's rituals or new rituals that Jewish women have created. It's called ritualwell.org, another place where there are tremendous, tremendous resources. And I would also look at Lilith magazine, an oldie but goodie, a Jewish feminist magazine. I think there's also a J Girls magazine for young women that maybe you looked at when you were younger. What else? I think probably those are the major resources. There's a website which I believe is called Keshet, and we can just hold this for a moment. Okay, I'm back. KeshetOnline.org is an amazing resource for LGBTQI and other letters. For resources. It's just a terrific resource, well worth exploring.
Thank you so much for all that. And like, again, as we said earlier, we loved having you, and we're excited to like format it and send you what the final product looks like.
Well, students can also take my course in Jewish feminism at UVA.
Oh yeah, that's for future awesome. Resources, take your course.
Yeah, we'll plug that in the podcast to take your class.
Oh God, I yearn for everyone being able to go to Hillel for dinner.
Yeah, I miss that a lot.
And we just had our renovation, and we got to use it for a little bit there, but not in its full force.
So I love you both. It was really wonderful to hang out together.
Hee hee.
Hee hee.